And that last song was Last Christmas by Ariana Grande. Now, our last song for junior semester of me for the winter is the absolute classic Christmas song, All I Want for Christmas Is You. But this will be the last song from Malata Stargazing for Songs for a Christmas Vibe. Had so much fun hanging out with y'all. I'm on every Thursdays 5 to 6. Next semester, I will be abroad, so I don't know. I will try my hardest to keep my show and do it even while I'm abroad. So stay on the lookout for that if you like what I do. So yeah, let's just get into it. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3. My name is Ari, and this is Maladaptive Stargazing. So let's go.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. There is just one thing I need. I don't care about the presents underneath the Christmas tree. I just want you for my own, more than you could ever know. Make my wish come.
I don't care. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to WRCT Pittsburgh. As we continue our programming, we have our public affairs section here on Ebony Spectrum, and we have Ebony Spectrum and In Black America. So stay with us and get informed.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
He was a big band leader who traveled all over the country from the late 20s into the 60s. And he was always telling these stories about life on the road. And I had some exposure to it because as I was growing up, he was still traveling, but as they say, youth is wasted on the young. I have listened and I have cared, but at some point, in talking to some other music historians about the importance of getting as many stories down, I said to my dad, "Let's get some of your stories down. Maybe I can get a book out of it." And he embraced the idea wholeheartedly. He was excited. He started, every time I'd go home from Boston to visit, we would set aside some time to record conversations.
Carmen Fields, Emmy Award-winning broadcast news journalist and author of Going Back to T-Town, the Ernie Fields Territory Big Band, published by University of Oklahoma Press. As a child growing up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Fields heard her father tell stories about life on the road in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, touring with his 17-piece orchestra. In the mid-1980s, she decided to record those memories from her father, but it took COVID-19 for her to officially put pen to paper for this book. Ernest Ernie Lawrence Field was a pioneer musician in the field of territory bands. He was a trombonist, pianist, musical director, and band leader. He also owned his own record label, Frisco Records. He recorded and distributed records of his orchestra, a feat that was highly unusual at the time, especially when done solo without the help of a promoter or agent. I'm John L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Going Back to T-Town with Carmen Fields, In Black America.
I'm going back to T-Town to get my women in line. Yes, I'm going back to Tulsa to get my women in line. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Launch event was at Wellesley Books, an independent store, bookstore in Wellesley, Massachusetts, and it was standing room only. The room seats 70 people, and every seat was full, and there was a waiting list, and all I was done. And the week after that, I went out to Oklahoma for 3 events, and one of the 3, the bookseller that I was in partnership with, ran out of books.
Mm.
And he had ordered, I think he said he brought along 75. And right after that, it was listed on the Oklahoma, number 1 on the Oklahoma bestsellers list for nonfiction.
Consider this. When Ernie Fields started traveling with his nationally famous orchestra, it was barely a decade after the infamous 1921 race massacre in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and continued through the World War II years, a period that coincided with America's rigid segregation and sometimes dangerous hostility towards African Americans. The Ernie Fields story is one of challenges and perseverance until he finally achieved recognition of a gold record for his rock and roll rendition of the big band standard In the Mood. Born in Nacogdoches, Texas, he was raised in Taft, Oklahoma. He was a trained electrician, having graduated from Tuskegee Institute. As a child, Carmen Fields grew up in a house full of music. She would listen to her father, the melodies and stories. In her book, Going Back to T-Town, Carmen Fields tells her father's story in his own words, how he weathered the ups and downs of the music industry and maintained his optimism.
As I like to say, it was the best of times and worst of times. Yes, it was segregated, but everything that was needed, as far as I knew in my young, tender age, was right there in the black community. I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and it was known as Black Wall Street, and there were black-owned grocery stores, barbers, chili parlors, restaurants, dry cleaners, you name it. Everything you needed could be found within a very circumscribed area of Tulsa. So we had teachers that cared about us and that poured everything into us. I'm a product of Ralph J. Bunch Elementary School, Marian Anderson Junior High School, and Booker T. Washington High School. And we felt we were equipped to go out and face the world.
How did you happen to attend Lincoln University in Missouri?
At the time, Lincoln University was the only historical black college that had a degree program in journalism. And I knew from a very pretty young age that I wanted to study journalism. And at the time, Howard had a minor in journalism. Their famed program had not begun. Hampton had a minor, and then some other historically black colleges had maybe a course here or there in journalism, but Lincoln University had the only degree program, and that's how I selected it. Also, in Jefferson City, Missouri, it was far enough for me to be away from home and be independent, but it was close enough where I could get back and forth if I needed to or wanted to.
Now, was your first job in print or was it in broadcasting?
My first job was in broadcasting. I studied print journalism, but my senior year, I got an internship at the local television station in Jefferson City, Missouri. And so I worked there during my senior year through the internship, and then I was hired as the first of our race as a reporter at KRCG TV 13 in Jefferson City. And that was a whole new world because broadcast journalism I had never thought about. And, of course, there were so few women and so few people of color to even put that idea in the head. But I learned a lot. I knew I was going to graduate school soon, and so I had been accepted at Boston University and decided to pursue broadcast journalism in that sequence. But as fate would have it, when I graduated with my master's degree in hand, I couldn't find a job in radio or television to save my life. And as a quote-unquote fallback position, secured a job at the Boston Globe, which turned out to be one of the 10 best newspapers in the country at the time.
Now, when you went to the Globe, you were one among zero?
I was not one among zero. I was one of two African-American women, and there were, I believe, about six or seven others of us scattered around, one in sports and one on the urban team, one in magazine, but not too many at all, for sure.
I understand. You need to catch that?
No.
Okay. Now, talk to us about your fellowship at the Harvard Nieman Foundation.
Well, that is a well-established mid-career experience where they have 24 journalists, 12 American and 12 foreigners, who once awarded the scholarship or the fellowship can study anything you want to at Harvard University for a nine-month period. And additionally, the foundation supplements your classes with the various speakers and who come in and make presentations and give the latest information. One thing that stands out to me was hearing the latest medical research around the AIDS epidemic and HIV, and that was at a time when that was very mysterious and embryonic. Another had a special showing and fellowship conversation with David Hockney, the favorite, the famous modern artist. It was just a very enriching experience, and I was the only American broadcaster that had the fellowship that year. That was the class of 86, and there was one other broadcaster who was Canadian. But the fellows were from all over, including South Africa, Peru, Costa Rica, and from newspapers around the country, and had the benefit of lifelong friendships at that time.
Before we get into the conversation about your writing of about your dad and your latest book, growing up in Tulsa, you also covered the busing desegregation issue in Boston. How did that experience affect or assist you in covering those times in Boston?
Well, it was amazing, I think back on it and can't imagine how we made it through. But it's because Boston had such a reputation for uprightness and fairness and the cradle of liberty, and to see all of those rumors dispelled so quickly and so easily by young toughs, well, young and old toughs, as it turned out, it was. I don't know. Words fail me on what the times were, but one thing that I took away from that, and I mentioned also that the Globe received a Pulitzer Prize for public service for its coverage of school desegregation during that time. My dependence on the black community to help lead me to stories that needed to be told, that needed to be on the pages of the Globe, was just amazing. The people at my sorority meetings, the people in my beauty parlor, people at church, all had a way of helping lead me to, I need to talk to a parent who has student at South Boston High School. I need to talk to a student who is playing a sport. I just name it, and I'd have two or three leads in no time, and that was very enriching, rewarding, and to this day, I give the homage and credit to the black community being the wind beneath my wings.
I understand. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Dr. Carmen Field, Emmy Award-winning broadcast news journalist and author of Going Back to T-Town, the Ernie Field Territorial Big Band. Ms. Fields, talk to us about 1980, you getting your dad talking about his career.
I did. He was a big band leader who traveled all over the country from the late 20s into the 60s. And he was always telling these stories about life on the road. And I had some exposure to it because as I was growing up, he was still traveling. But as they say, youth is wasted on the young. I half listened and I half cared. And but at some point, in talking to some other music historians, and about the importance of getting as many stories down, I said to my dad, let's get some of your stories down. Maybe I can get a book out of it. Mm-hmm. And he embraced the idea wholeheartedly. He was excited. He started, every time I'd go home from Boston to visit, we would set aside some time to record conversations. And I even taught him how to use a cassette tape recorder so that if he thought of something when I was not there, he could get that information down. I enlisted him to put names on all of these photographs of these people that had been musicians in his organization. Just he embraced the idea wholeheartedly, and I am so thankful for that, because even after he died in 1992, when I much later got serious about putting some of this together, I was finding little notes on scraps of paper where he had written and sent me, be sure and put so-and-so's name in. Be sure and mention so-and-so if you can. Here's his phone number. He was just invaluable, and trying to keep his voice in that story more than my voice was very important to me in putting the book together.
Now, he was born in Nacogdoches, Texas, and that would cut me living in Texas. That initially sparked my interest. But then they moved to Taft, Oklahoma. How did that happen?
Well, there were two or three different stories on how that happened. The one most often repeated was that my grandfather, my Ernie Fields' father, who was a minister and a college-trained minister, I'm proud to say he was a college graduate, graduated in the 1870s, he decided to run for some public office in Nacogdoches on the Republican ticket, which was common for African Americans during that day. And I don't know, I haven't been able to find what office it was, but the family, the oral history says they tried to discourage him from doing it. And he insisted and ran anyway. And it split the vote or split the ticket, and someone from another political party was the winner. And it so enraged the powers that be that they had to sell off their belongings very quickly and migrate to Taft, where another of my dad's brothers already had established residencies there. And Taft, Oklahoma, your listeners may know, is another one of the all-black enclaves that dotted Oklahoma during that day.
Now, it's been said that the most difficult sentence to write is the first sentence in a book that the author has to come up with. I'm always interested in why one begins a book. You begin the book, Discovery of a $5 Tip and a Chance at the Big Time. Why start the book there?
Well, I decided, and this is over several different iterations and starts and false starts and other starts. I decided that the most important thing was for the arc of the story to be when he was discovered,
mm-hmm.
and the ending to be when he had his largest musical triumph.
Okay.
And so that was why I started the book with the story of how he was discovered, how this whole orchestra came to be. And then fit in other places, other biographical or experiences on the road. But it was very deliberately not he was born and then it was not a chronological story. I guess that's my journalism coming out. I wanted to get the most important aspects in the lead.
Now, your dad was college educated. How did he happen to get to Tuskegee Institute, now Tuskegee University?
His older brother, who was, I think Uncle Clarence was like 8 or 9 years older than him.
Mm-hmm.
The whole family believed firmly in education. And apparently when Booker T. Washington was alive, he had come through Taft, Oklahoma on a circuit recruiting or touting the education of Tuskegee, and that piqued my uncle's attention and interest, and he went to Tuskegee, enrolled, His trade was shoemaking, but he was also a musician, and he came back and worked to help my father, who was the youngest of six, to go to Tuskegee and study. And my father had taken up, he wanted to be an electrician. That was his designated trade, but he was also interested in music, but never dreaming that that would become his vocation.
Now, was your dad playing trombone while he was at Tuskegee, and it was something that he did on the side?
That's right. He bought his first instrument, a used trombone, for $6. They had a $3 down payment, and the band director, who had also taught his brother, couldn't believe, how did you come to Tuskegee without a horn? You didn't have a horn.
Exactly.
So he got a horn, and with one of his fellow classmates who was also studying to be an electrician, in their spare time from working on the electric plant, his friend would give him drills. Mm-hmm. And he learned and was in the second band or the junior band, and worked very hard and soon was promoted to the major band, which he loved because in those days the band traveled with the football team,
right,
and you get to go around to these other colleges and see these other things.
Now, your dad was either going to work or coming back from work when he heard some folks practicing, and he went to see what was going on, and
yes,
he decided that he wanted to join them?
Yes, he was on a trouble call, as they call it, and had gone to this apartment complex, and while there he heard some folks rehearsing, and so he stopped by to listen and make their acquaintance, and they encouraged him. They said, well, this is not our whole group. We're going to be playing such and such a place on Friday night. Why don't you come hear us? And he did, and then gradually started rehearsing and practicing with them and going on their dates. And at some point, he never was sure whether it was because he was older than they were, because most of them were still in high school, or whether it was because he had been to college. But at some point, they asked him to be their leader, and that's when he decided to change the name of the organization to his name, since he was the leader, and that's the Ernie Fields Orchestra was born.
Now, this is 1920, I believe. How precarious was it to, one, have a band with 17 or 18 members and then get on the road?
Well, this was the late 20s, early 30s, and it was dangerous. It was very dangerous.
To say the least.
It was a time when you didn't know whether, if you smiled too much or too little, whether you could end up dead or injured or what. But I'm not sure what gave my father the confidence, besides him always acknowledging that the good Lord was looking out for him. But they had some hairy times, but on the whole, they just made do. If they couldn't find a place that would serve them, they would go on until they found some place. On occasion, he had white musicians in his organization, and one that he hired, he said, I like to think I hire a person because of his musical skill, but you can be helpful to us on the road getting food. So, whatever mechanism he could, and, of course, paying close attention to whatever laws or customs that there were at the time, and being a solid performer. He loved to put on a show. He prided himself in having a group of clean-cut, upright musicians, a finely tuned organization, and I'm sure that helped in some ways, too, to smooth over some of the spots.
Now, I found it interesting when you wrote about your mom and you're talking about your dad, that he said that your mom probably had money from her first paycheck.
That's what he said. She was a saver for sure. And that helped keep the family afloat. Mm-hmm. Not only was she a professional, and while he was traveling, he would send money home to help pay for the bills. And he said he was always surprised that mm-hmm. there was ever anything left over from what he had sent home. But, yeah, she knew how to squeeze six pennies out of a nickel for sure.
Now, your dad didn't accomplish what he needed to accomplish by himself. Talk to us about Bob Wills.
Bob Wills was a famous country and Western performer who was mm-hmm. based in Tulsa. Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys was his organization. And he also had a radio show, a popular radio show on one of the 50,000 watt stations. So he was heard all across the region into Texas and across Oklahoma. And I don't know how their paths crossed, mm-hmm. but they became friends. And Bob Wills was instrumental in getting my father into some of the previously all-white venues, the most famous of which is Kane's Ballroom in Tulsa, which is getting ready to celebrate its centennial in 2024. But that was one of the crown jewels of performance venues, and Bob Wills threatened not to perform there himself unless they opened it to Ernie Fields, and Ernie Fields became the very first of our race to perform there. And he opened his eyes to different booking strategies, how much to ask for, what percentage of the gate you should ask for, what the appropriate down payments were. Just was a superb friend and business advisor.
Talk to us about T-Town Blues.
Oh, that was one of the songs that my father wrote, the lyrics of which he wrote, and it was one of his very first recordings when John Hammond, the talent scout, brought him and his organization to New York City in 1939.
Carmen Fields, Emmy Award-winning broadcast news journalist and author of Going Back to T-Town, the Ernie Fields Territory Band. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
I was burdened down in a world of sin. I had no God on my side. I was lost in the darkness of the night. But now everything is all right. And I can sing and pray. Yeah. Oh. You saved my soul. I'm so glad. Oh. Oh, yes, I am. Oh, you saved my soul. I'm so glad.
what's up? It's Friday, so I'm going to keep it black. But I'm going to keep it brief. Pray for your friends in Georgia. We are not okay. Another inmate has unfortunately died in Fulton County jails. That's 10 this year. Sean Delmore was found unresponsive in his cell. In August, Samuel Lawrence petitioned a federal court for relief, stating that he had been subjected to excessive force and that officers stood by and watched while other prisoners attacked him, and he died 4 days later. A civil rights investigation was launched on the jail after LaShawn Thompson was found dead and covered in bug bites last September. You know abortion is illegal here after 6 weeks now. And Georgia also legally restricted gender-affirming surgeries and hormone replacement therapies for anyone below 18. In Florida, Texas, and Alabama are out loud and proud about it, I think it's clear by now that Georgia is just a sleeper. Speaking of Republicans, it seems ever since we turned blue in the last presidential election, Stacey, they've had a vendetta against us. Giving very much, when you see our face, hope it gives you hell, hope it gives you hell. It do, girl. It's working. First, they illegally redrew district lines in order to weaken the black vote. How that work? How state lawmakers illegally do the law? Well, after three lawsuits were filed, a U.S. district judge ruled that last March, parts of Georgia's redistricting plan probably violated federal law, but they allowed them to remain in place in the 2020 midterm election, citing that changes that close to the elections would be a disaster. But we back, baby. The trial kicked off earlier this week, and according to the Voting Rights Act, voting district lines can't result in discriminatory effects against minority voters, who must be allowed a chance to elect candidates of their choosing. Period. And according to the lawsuit, that's exactly what happened. In 2020, Republicans held an 8-6 majority in Georgia's U.S. House delegation. And at the election, they redrew the district map to eliminate one of those Democratic seats, boosting the majority to 9-5. But it still doesn't seem the outcome of the trial will shake Republicans' control of either the House or the Senate. They literally just wanted one less person with empathy, practicing their constitutional right to participate in the legislative process that will be advocating for black rights in policymaking. This is in addition, of course, to the food and water restrictions for people in voting lines, the strict identification requirements, and restrictions on drop box submissions. It became clear in the years since the election that these folks are hell-bent on getting their get back, because every little step we take is met with an onslaught of conservative backlash. Exhibit A, Cop City. We said no! And we said no for so many times for so many hours. Not only is it literally an unwanted use of taxpayers' money, it is an unnecessary militarization of an already incompetent and racist police force. Y'all was just using pictures of black men for target practice. But it is also an environmental threat. It's not just going to disrupt some green space, but the infrastructure is going to greatly increase our chances of flooding. And we're flooding right now. Just yesterday, after literally only an hour of rain, global warming, it flooded all up and through the Atlanta University Center and the West End. Oh, the poor black areas. Child, I'm over it. I was just about to say I was here when y'all shut down the city over the snow. And I vouch for y'all, because why would we ever have salt trucks in Georgia? But you are purposely making matters worse, but I get it now. It will only adversely affect the black people's property, and y'all trying to take back your city anyway. We see you, my boy. So gung-ho on Cop City that these folks done slapped the protesters' bail fund with the RICO. Girl, Georgia, you might have ate with these last couple of RICOs, but everybody don't need a RICO, girl. It's getting scary out here. These people are practicing their constitutional rights and openly being penalized for it. And on top of ignoring 20 hours of public comment, the state now has the nerve to hold up the processing of the Stop Cop City petition that holds over 100,000 signatures. Not only are we saying no, we are doing so in accordance with the law. So please tell us how people are supposed to gauge the democratic process to get what we need. The success of Cop City matters to the rest of the U.S. because if it happens here, it can literally happen anywhere. So I want to hear from community organizers, activists, and leaders in the comments. What can we do in the face of a government that not only abandons us, but actively chooses to fight against any progress we make? And on top of that, it's positioning its effort whole time worried about the wrong thing. Our governor is claiming that Joe Biden's economic policies are directly to blame for the record high inflation and taking more money out of the middle class families' pockets. With that, just doesn't make any sense. Everybody knows. Everybody with sense, girl. They actively choose not to operate with sense. Well, everyone should understand that presidents inherit the state of the economy from the last person that was in office, because 4 to 8 years isn't long enough to stabilize an economy. But I guess we wouldn't also dare give dangerous politicians an extended period of control because of the very things I just mentioned in this episode. The way we do things is just really tired and old, and it doesn't make sense anymore. Long story short, y'all's governor is saving us 31 cents a gallon. Thanks. Cheaper gas is cheaper gas, I guess. But if you really wanted to make some money, instead of all this Cop City and NRA business, you could maybe legalize the other kind of gas. I hear California and the Canadians are doing very well on that front. I don't know, just think about it.
This is a commentary on the Black World Media Network.
Hey, this is Bill Fletcher, former president of Trans Africa Forum, longtime labor activist and writer, back at you. And we're going to talk about labor. Unless you've been under a rock, you know that the United Auto Workers struck the big three this past week. And the ripples are already being felt across the country and the economy, et cetera. One of the interesting things about this is the stance of Biden, who, contrary to most prior presidents, has actually come out in favor of the demands of the strikers and raised something that I was surprised to hear about essentially the redistribution of the wealth and the fact that these companies have been making money hand over fist, and it's time for the workers to get something from this. I think it's very important that people support this strike. This strike, just like the strike of the SAG-AFTRA workers in Hollywood, the Writers Guild of America workers in Hollywood, the almost strike of the Teamsters, the contract negotiations among the flight attendants going on, these have much broader implications than just for the workers in those particular industries or under those particular collective bargaining agreements. These are really fights around the redistribution of wealth. They're fights, as we see in the SAG-AFTRA and Writers Guild battle, around the question of artificial intelligence and the impact that that has on the workforce and people generally. And for the folks in Hollywood that are striking, what's really interesting here is that the issue of artificial intelligence is being raised not simply because of the fear of artificial intelligence creating some sort of Terminator creature in any humanity, but that the way that the capitalists can use that to further extract wealth, to minimize the workforce, and to create products with fewer and fewer workers. This is why it's time for us to be there with these workers that are on strike, auto workers, Writers Guild, Screen Actors Guild, AFTRA, etc. It goes on. This is the time. Thanks. This is Bill. You'll catch me soon. Take care.
Keep listening to the Black World Media Network and hear outstanding commentaries from some of the finer minds of the diaspora.
On the Black World Media Network, this is Book Bundle, a review of literary works in varying media formats. Here is the reviewer, Professor Todd Stephen Burroughs.
I'm Todd Stephen Burroughs. Oh my God, I've got so much back stuff to mention. I'm literally just going to take this commentary and mention some things. You can follow up on them, hopefully, at your local bookstore or wherever you buy your books. First of all, let's talk about Rita Dove. She's going to receive the National Book Foundation's Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters. That is NBF's Lifetime Achievement Award. Dove's body of work includes 11 books of poetry, a collection of her poet laureate lectures, a short story collection, and a play. She is the winner of the 1987 Pulitzer Prize for Thomas and Bueller, her third collection of poetry. From 1993 to 1995, Dove served as the first Black Poet Laureate of the United States, and she is the only poet to date to have received both the National Humanities Medal and the National Medal of Arts. Poet Jericho Brown will present this award to Dove at the 73rd Annual National Book Awards on November 15th. On behalf of the Black World Media Network, congratulations to Rita Dove. I want to mention a graphic novel done by Ibram X. Kendi. Kendi is a very well-known scholar who has developed this kind of anti-racism curriculum that has really angered the right. And so he's done a lot of different things, main books, textbooks, books for children. And in this case, he has a graphic novel called Stamped from the Beginning. It is a graphic history of racist ideas in America. Kendi is continuing his anti-racism campaign, and he's continuing to use books. He also, by the way, has an online Black newspaper, The Emancipator, that is done in cooperation with the Boston Globe. So if you're interested in more of these ideas, you can definitely check out The Emancipator. The book is called, again, Stamped from the Beginning, and this is one of many, many books that Kendi has. Now, this last month was Black August. And Black August is where elements of the Black activist community bring attention to Black political prisoners. I am the consultant to an exhibit at Brown University dealing with the papers of Mumia Abu-Jamal. But I wanted to point out a rally that Prison Radio is part of in Washington, D.C. That rally is on the birthday of a very well-known Native American political prisoner, Leonard Peltier. Leonard Peltier turned 79 on September 12th, and he has been under lock and key now for almost 50 years, according to Prison Radio's email that I have. And I wanted to bring up Leonard Peltier because I wanted to mention his book, My Life is My Sundance. Has a lot of his writings there. And it's important, I think, to recognize these imprisoned authors, particularly the political prisoner authors. Now, let's move on to Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. The great African author has a children's book called Mama's Sleeping Scarf. It's a tender story about a little girl's love for her mother's scarf and the adventures she shares with it and her whole family. Chino loves the scarf that her mama ties around her hair at night. When mama leaves for the day, Chino takes it on endless adventures. Peeking through the colorful haze of the silky scarf, Chino Boy Bunny can look at her whole family as they go through their routines. So that's Mama's Sleeping Scarf from Sister Adichie. As we know, is a treasure of African letters and a daughter of Nigeria's. Another book I want to point out, The Artivist. This is a children's book that encourages children to become artists and activists. So you know we like that here at the Black World Media Network. This book is written by Nicholas Smith, who defines himself as an artivist from Houston, Texas. And he's a Hollywood film illustrator. Art and activism has always gone hand in hand in the African-American community and in the African community. So let's support this book, The Artivist, and give it to our children to get them both in a political and a cultural mode. I want to point out there is a Q&A about Tina Turner. The article is called What's God Got to Do With It? PW talks with Ralph H. Craig III. And Craig, who's a lecturer of religion at Dartmouth, traces Tina Turner's spiritual path in his book called Dancing in My Dreams, which comes out in November. So look up What's God Got to Do With It? That's got to be a fascinating discussion, since Tina Turner was probably one of the most famous African-American Buddhists to ever exist. Now, one more book, Jelani's Key, another children's book. It's a new middle grade book, and it's published by the AALBC, our African-American book publisher for young readers. And here's the plot. Tata was now among the ancestors, but he left his grandson, Jelani, a golden key and a note bearing a cryptic riddle. Find Karakamun. Mourning his late grandfather and with little to go on, 11-year-old Jelani must set off to fulfill Tata's mysterious wishes. His quest will put him on a collision course with a legend and immerse him in a mind-bending overnight challenge that, if navigated successfully, will unveil his grandfather's true legacy and change Jelani's life forever. Again, that's the book Jelani's Key, by D. Amari Jackson. Okay, there's so much more I could talk about, but I think that is enough. Please go support your local Black bookstore. Go support your independent bookstore. Buy online. There's a treasure trove to deal with. We're in a golden age, and we don't know it. So I'll declare it right now. We're in a golden age. I'm Todd Stephen Burroughs.
That was Book Bundle, a review of literary works in varying media formats, presented by reviewer Professor Todd Stephen Burroughs, journalist, historian, and popular culture enthusiast.
Democratic candidate Lindsey Powell defeated her Republican challenger Erin Connolly Ottenreef with a margin of about 65% to 34%. Both candidates were running to replace former state representative Sarah Inamorato, who resigned earlier this year, to focus on her bid for Allegheny County executive. The state house will now keep its Democratic majority of 102 seats compared to the GOP's 101. Both candidates weighed in on the results. Take a listen.
I've been running on a platform of making tangible change, making sure that we have policy programs and projects that we can see, feel, and touch. And so making sure that in the budget we have those things at the forefront is critically important to me.
I care so much about the community. I have such great ideas. I think I just lost on the mail-in ballots. I want them to do so much better with reducing crime in our city. I want our schools to do so much better with performance.
Powell will complete remainder of Inamorato's two-year term and will be up for re-election next November.
Registering to vote is getting a little bit easier in Pennsylvania. You can do it automatically when you get or renew your driver's license.
But as KDK political editor John Delano reports, not everyone likes the idea.
Pennsylvania
is an automatic.
In announcing on social media that he was making voter registration automatic at the DMV, Governor Shapiro said he was fulfilling a campaign pledge.
I made a commitment when I was campaigning for this office that we would bring automatic voter registration in Pennsylvania and break down the barriers for legal, eligible voters.
It's a system used in 23 other states, both Republican and Democratic, registering drivers automatically as voters unless they choose to opt out. Until now in Pennsylvania, you were not registered unless you affirmatively opted in.
It's really a matter of improving voter access. We have more than 1.5 million Pennsylvanians, according to census records, who are eligible to register to vote, but are not yet registered to vote.
Some officials, like Allegheny County Councilman Sam DeMarco, who serves on the election board, is concerned that both underage residents and non-citizens could get registered. DeMarco recalls back in 2017 when a few foreign citizens actually got registered to vote through the DMV.
Non-citizens and underage folks can get driver's license before they're eligible to vote. Now, I remain to be seeing the details as to what the governor and Secretary Schmidt are going to put in place to ensure that doesn't happen again.
Pennsylvania's top election official, Secretary of State Al Schmidt, a Republican, says he brought that case to the attention of officials back in 2017, and
the Department of State, working with Department of Transportation and PennDOT, changed that system so that any applicant who is not a citizen would not be prompted to begin this process.
DeMarco says he wants every legal eligible voter to be registered in Pennsylvania. Right now, about 1.7 million Pennsylvanians are not registered. But he also questions the governor's timing for making registration automatic.
The unilateral aspect of this, for him to just come out and announce it today, you know, weeks before we have competitive elections statewide, as well as in jurisdictions like here in Allegheny County and also in Philadelphia, you know, and without going through the legislature.
Officials tell me that federal law gives the governor authority to do what he did. Of course, how many more people get registered and who among them vote remain unanswered questions. John Delano, KDKA TV News.
Now, if you're in New York, you may have noticed the traffic jams and street closures, the type of gridlock that can only mean the United Nations General Assembly has kicked off in the city. World leaders have arrived, raising the alarm on the world's most pressing issues, war, coup d'etat, the climate crisis, just to name a few. It's one of those days when you realize what leading, what presidenting actually involves, and how the role, when done correctly, means calling for unity over crises like Russia and Ukraine. With Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressing fellow world leaders in his first in-person visit since the invasion of his country began. It also means the tense navigation of foreign policy, where lives are at stake. Ahead of today's remarks by the Iranian president, Iran and the U.S., longtime antagonists, struck a rare deal. Five Americans detained in Iran are now free and made their emotional return to U.S. soil early this morning. The release was part of a prisoner exchange agreement that will grant Tehran access to oil revenues previously frozen by U.S. sanctions. Leaders, including President Biden, also issued dire warnings about climate change.
We see it everywhere. Record-breaking heat waves in the United States and China. Wildfires ravaging North America and Southern Europe. A fifth year of drought in the Horn of Africa. Tragic, tragic flooding in Libya. My heart goes out to the people of Libya. That's killed thousands, thousands of people.
The UN is gathering as the city of Derna in eastern Libya is still counting its dead after devastating floods struck more than a week ago. Experts say the storm was more likely to occur and more intense because of human-caused climate change. The World Health Organization and the UN say 4,000 deaths have so far been reported. These are crises that are urgent, hard to resolve, and which impact literally the entire world. And yet, Republicans and MAGA world continue to trivialize them, Climate change? A hoax. Bringing detained Americans home? Slammed by a twice-impeached former president who did nothing to free them during his time in office and whose Iran policy was an abject failure. Allocating aid to fight Putin? Nah, let's just focus on a bogus plot to impeach Biden. It's all part of their more nefarious plot to dismantle democracy, a crisis that Biden challenged on the world stage.
Will we find within ourselves the courage to do what must be done, to preserve the planet, to protect human dignity, to provide opportunity for people everywhere, and to defend the tenets of the United Nations? There can only be one answer to that question. We must, and we will.
These are big presidential priorities, epic, historic, and it helps to have an adult in the room. It is a timely reminder that a president is not someone who entertains you on TV. The threat to our democracy at home remains serious. But as Tom Nichols writes in The Atlantic, Americans are sleepwalking through this national emergency. And that includes Democrats and the media. He says, quote, Democrats and their liberal allies claim to be in full mobilization mode to stop Trump and defang his threat to the constitutional order. But are they? How much more hand-wringing will they do over Biden's age, over whether he's doing enough for climate change or to forgive student loans? How many more times will Trump's opponents in the pro-democracy coalition internalize the right's criticisms about inflation, about spending, about gasoline, and respond to them as if Republicans care one whit about policy? Because, of course, they don't. The modern-day Republican Party has only one principle left: to be reelected by any means necessary so that they hold on to power, which is exactly why President Biden sounded the alarm once again on our biggest crisis yet, saying in a fundraiser last night, quote, in 2024, democracy is on the ballot once again. And let there be no question, Donald Trump and his MAGA Republicans are determined to destroy American democracy. And I will always defend, protect, and fight for our democracy. That is why I'm running. Biden has improved America's standing in the world, but Donald Trump is threatening to blow it all up all over again. Joining me now is David Rothkopf, columnist for The Daily Beast and host of the Deep State Radio podcast, and Tara Settmeyer, senior advisor to the Lincoln Project and former Republican communications director. Thank you both for being here. David, I want to read a little bit more of this Tom Nichols piece, which I think was quite good today. And he writes the following in The Atlantic. America is in a state of emergency, yet few of its citizens seem to realize it. For example, a single senator, Tommy Tuberville of Atlanta, has been holding up hundreds of military promotions for months, endangering the national security of the United States. The acting chief of naval operations says it will take years for the Navy to recover from the damage. Welcome news, no doubt, in Beijing. Few people outside of America's senior military leadership seem particularly concerned. What do you make of the state of our democracy as it stands on the world stage and Biden's representation and defense of it?
Well, I think the world knows that democracy in the United States is in a more fragile state than it has been in any of our lifetimes, so that Donald Trump and the people around Donald Trump represent that threat, and they could return to power. Having said that, they also know who Joe Biden is. Joe Biden ran about defending democracy. When he speaks in private to Democratic donors, he speaks of defending democracy. When he gets on the world stage, he talks about defending democracy. He takes steps to defend democracy against Trump's friends like Vladimir Putin in Ukraine. He has done everything that you can imagine from an American president who understands the job and understands the stakes in order to protect democracy. And I think the reason he's running again is because he realizes that he and Kamala Harris represent the last best hope of the United States to defeat the Trump forces, to defeat the authoritarian forces in the United States, and to preserve our democracy. And I don't think that's an overstatement.
You know, Tara, you know, Tom Nichols was, you know, pretty critical of the media for a lot of reasons, which I think has not learned at all how to cover Trump. I think full stop. The media writ large is still covering him the same way they did in 2016 and 2020. But also of Democrats who, and look, the issues that Democrats are in complaint of the Biden administration about are important. Student loan debt, you know, relief would change millions of American lives. You know, he's doing a lot on climate, but also gave Joe Manchin a lot. Those are legitimate complaints. But I think Tom Nichols' point is that arguing about that and about Biden's age and like nitpicking that right now, when on the other side is Trump and DeSantis and people like Ramaswamy, seems short-sighted. What do you make of that criticism?
My good friend Tom Nichols is 100% correct about this. You know, I joke all the time with my Democratic friends and say, you know, Republicans fall in line, Democrats need to fall in love. That's the joke, you know, amongst us in Washington about this. And I just sit back and I go, what are you guys doing? None of these policy positions matter if our democracy falls apart. And I don't think that the case has been made enough comparing and contrasting what that means. I don't think people really truly understand what we're facing here, what the existential threat to our democracy looks like. Democracy is a decision. Democracy does not defend itself. Institutions do not defend themselves. It takes the righteous anger of the American people to stand up and push back against the authoritarian forces that are now coalesced behind one major political party in this country. This next election, President Biden was 100% correct. It is about democracy. It's America or Trumpism, period, full stop. I just came back from a conference in Germany, and I can tell you that there were a lot of high-powered folks there, from elected officials to business leaders, who looked at us Americans who were there and said, you guys cannot fail. There is no one else to replace you in America as the beacons of democracy in the world. Europe and the rest of the world cannot survive if American democracy falls. It was a very sobering experience to hear our European allies plead to us, saying, what are you guys doing there? We need you. Who fills that power vacuum? It sure as hell isn't a pro-democracy country. It's Russia. It's China. It's our enemies who would fill that vacuum if America went under. So for President Biden to step up, which I think he's doing an excellent job of doing, to step up and explain that that's what's on the ballot, I think that the Democrats need to understand this and coalesce around that message and explain to the American people what it means if we lose our democracy. Lincoln Project has put out all week long, we're putting out pro-Biden, pro-democracy messaging to remind people this is what's at stake, this is what he's doing, and this is the choice. And that's what the messaging has to be moving forward.
Trump lawyer turned RICO defendant Rudy Giuliani has a new problem. His own recent former lawyer, Robert Costello, is suing Giuliani, saying he owes over $1 million in unpaid legal fees. Costello represented Giuliani in several cases and probes. He was even listed as unindicted co-conspirator one in the Jack Smith probe. That's Giuliani's big problem. He also was indicted in Georgia for RICO coup activities. Giuliani also has legal fees from cases by Dominion and Smartmatic voting companies over alleged defamation and election lies. He also was found liable for defaming Georgia election workers. This is what Giuliani says on Newsmax.
You have all these crazy legal bills. You shouldn't be in the position you're in, but you're in it. And
well,
folks,
we'll fight our way out. We always do, because we're on the right side, Greg.
That's his view. We also saw Giuliani going to a bail bonds agency for $150,000 bail for his recent Georgia arraignment. Donald Trump is hosting a fundraiser for Giuliani's mounting fees, while the former mayor's son says it won't be enough to get through this. You have Giuliani and his own former lawyer now in a conflict once memorably captured by Destiny's Child. At first, we started out real cool. Now you have the audacity to come and step to me, holding money from me until you get your check. And as it was once put, the question becomes, can you pay my bills? Do you pay my automobiles? If you did, then maybe we could chill. I don't think you do, so you and me are through. Well, that would seem to be the problem and the scenario for Mr. Giuliani and his lawyer, as the now RICO defendant Giuliani cannot pay his lawyer bills. And the bills are piling up.
Thanks for listening. WRCT Pittsburgh.
There's a bright side somewhere. Let's not rest until we find it. There's a bright side somewhere. There's more joy somewhere. There's more joy somewhere. Let's not rest until we find it. There's more joy somewhere.
Tuned in to Pandemonium, a public affairs anthology from WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. And now, Pandemonium.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. It's time for another edition of Pandemonium here. It's been a pretty new show. It's going for a few weeks now. Basically, DJs just do whatever they want to do. My name's Bill. I normally do a heavy metal show on Sunday nights called To Evil Have a Human Name, but I'm also